I saw The Force Awakens last night. My first Star Wars experience of any kind in many, many years. And if you are the kind of person who can appreciate movies from nothing more than a visual perspective, I thought this was a feast. It might be the most visually stimulating movie I've ever seen. It's maybe the most visually ambitious movie I've ever seen. Quite something. And I'm thinking that comment doesn't ruin anything for anybody. It is worth seeing. J.J. Abrams' work is quite something. It's Current State here for Wednesday. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. For decades, our first guest has been on the inside of many a political campaign and controversy. Officially, Mark Grebner is the president of Lansing's Practical Political Consulting. That's a campaign services and voter list organization. He serves as the firm's lead campaign consultant. He's also served more than three decades on the Ingham County Board of Commissioners, from which he retired a couple of years ago. Less officially, Grebner is an ardent liberal known widely for his political savvy and his irreverent, often provocative and off-the-cuff commentary. I caught up with him a few days ago to talk politics. I first asked Mark Grebner what he makes of the state's decision to eliminate straight-ticket voting.
In the first place, since the Republicans control absolutely everything in state government now, the courts at every level, both houses of the legislature, the governorship, they've taken to going back and kind of kicking us, the Democrats. And so each little thing that's in the election law that helps us in any way, they're going back and fixing. They're moving the dates of elections. They're moving the way that elections are conducted. They're changing the way voter registration occurs. They're just doing everything. And they always come up with some explanation, which they didn't think of before, but now that they've thought of it, they have an explanation. So they have an explanation for getting rid of straight-ticket voting, which everybody pretty well agrees is a slight benefit to the Democratic Party and to the Democratic candidates.
A lot of opponents are using the word suppress to describe what this measure does. How exactly does it suppress votes? Is suppress really the right word?
I think suppress, you ought to have at least dogs and water cannons and deputy sheriffs that are sort of, you know, with standing around with whips or something.
So it doesn't quite rise to the level of suppress?
No, it's just that every way that they can, change the election law, you know, if there are two ways to do it and we were doing it one way and it helped the Democrats, they're going back through and fixing that.
40 or more states don't allow straight ticket voting. Would you say it's as politically motivated in those 40 states as you're suggesting that it is here in Michigan?
That's actually a red herring, the idea that other states do it some other way. Every state conducts elections in such complicated, different ways than anybody understands that it really isn't meaningful. The reason this is remarkable is that Michigan's a Democratic state. And for the Republicans to control the entire process really is an indication that either they are geniuses or we are complete nitwits.
Do you expect longer lines at the polls? A lot of clerks are anticipating that or seem to anticipate that.
There's a risk of a longer line, but lines at polls have to do, there are a lot of factors that go into lines. So that it would only be the presidential general election which would be affected because we don't see lines at other elections generally. And it would be in particular situations where there were very large numbers of voters and the precincts were badly drawn. I don't think it's exactly the Republicans' goals to create those lines. And I do think that the clerks are mainly worried because they just don't like even spot problems here and there.
Mark Grebner of Practical Political Consulting is our guest here on Current State. Michigan's presidential primary is set for March 8th. What kind of role will Michigan play next year?
Well, I don't know what kind of, if we'll have any real effect on the outcome, but I think it's going to be a really fun election here. We're going to be voting at almost the peak of interest. People love to be participating in a story, and this will be a story on both sides.
I've heard people claim just the opposite. I've heard there's going to be so many people winnowed out of the process by March 8th. All the sound and the fury will be behind us. You're not of that opinion.
Well, again, I don't know how important Michigan's vote will be. I'm not saying that our vote will be determinative of anything. Might be, might not be. But I'm saying that by the time we vote, that there will be candidates who are up and there will be candidates who are down. There will be candidates who are coming, trying to launch a comeback. There will be media storylines everywhere. And remember, our voting starts 45 days before March 8th because the absentee ballots are mailed out. And so the absentee ballots will be mailed out and in people's hands before the people vote in Iowa or New Hampshire. I really just think that we're going to have a huge turnout in this state. And there's the possibility of a large Democratic crossover on behalf of maybe Donald Trump. I just think we're going to have a very interesting election. The largest turnout we've ever had in a presidential primary. That's my guess.
If you had to guess, how many Republican candidates would you expect to be on the ballot on March 8th?
Well, we already know how many there will be because it's too late to withdraw.
But how many do you think will have dropped out of the race by then?
How many will look like they're not pathetic losers who are, you know, basically serving as doormats for the other ones? Oh, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 real Republican candidates at that point. Maybe we'll say 5.
And you anticipate Democrats playing a role in determining the GOP candidate. What exactly do you anticipate here?
Well, on the Democratic side, we have this very interesting race between Hillary and Bernie, and nobody really thinks that Bernie has a chance, and so it's more or less just like a play, you know, where we can go and you can cheer for Bernie or you can vote for the establishment. So the Democrats don't really have their heart in their primary. It'll be interesting enough to vote in. You can vote in it, you know. But it won't really mean much because we can all see that Bernie doesn't have the legs to run a long race.
But you anticipate Democrats voting for Trump, hoping to get him elected.
Or possibly for Cruz. We're like the cavalry. We don't know where we'll show up. But we're mounted, and we might just send a detachment of cavalry to help one or the other side.
Okay.
I personally have a warm spot in my heart for Cruz. But we don't have to make that decision until March 5th or so, and then we all have to decide, you know, would 100,000 votes for Don Trump cause more grief than doing something else on that day? Now, there will be a million Republican votes cast. I don't want to make it sound like the Democrats will overwhelm it. But even in a world where there are a million Republican votes, if there are 100,000 Democrats available to cause mischief, we could cause quite a bit of mischief.
If the primary were held today, who would you bet on? Besides Hillary, I mean, on the Republican side.
Well, if you actually held the election today, I guess Don Trump would actually win in Michigan. I think the polls are roughly right there. There hasn't been polling specific to Michigan that's been very good, but I believe the national numbers are about right.
What would you say is the most likely? So the most likely presidential matchup next year, would you say, is Trump versus Clinton?
No, I don't think that Don can really survive this process. I mean, there are all sorts of technical problems he'll run into. The Republican Party...
You talk about him like he's an old friend of yours.
I have watched the Donald, as has most of America, for many years. I have been appalled by him, I'd say, for 30 years. I think that people ought to look at his past and realize that he doesn't actually ever finish anything. He's a salesman. He sells things. And my guess, and I'm being sort of mean here, but my guess is that he's really looking for a deal. And you know, it can involve money, it can involve TV networks, but Don will get off the stage here pretty soon and somebody will have bought him out. And that's really, that's true of his real estate ventures, of his casinos. Really, this isn't about running the country. Don is just there for Don. So I don't think that he's the most likely Republican nominee. I would guess probably Rubio is the person who has the highest probability of being the nominee.
Well, how would a Clinton-Rubio matchup unfold, do you think?
In Michigan or in the country?
In the country.
I kind of expect that Hillary would win that. I'm not sure, but I think the Democrats have some advantages here, and I think that older Republican and independent women will find themselves voting for Clinton, even if they don't think they will today. So I think that she'll show quite a bit more strength than people imagine. We'll see.
Mark Grebner's our guest here on WKAR's Current State. You spent many years on the Ingham County Board of Commissioners, and as author of the county ethics policy, I'm obligated to ask you about the recent troubles in the IT department Two of its main people were let go recently for accepting tickets to sporting events from county vendors. Is no one paying attention to your policy?
No, I'd say just the opposite. When that surfaced, people pulled out the policy and discovered that there was almost nothing in it that was of any use, but they kept reading through it until they finally found a sentence or two they could hang them with. They thought about the ethics policy a lot. Ingham County has a pretty good reputation. And if you think about what these people did, they didn't take cash bribes. They didn't demand bribes. They didn't steal anything. They just kind of developed good friendships with the people who were selling for these companies. And you know, their good friends invited them to sporting events and picked up the tab for this and that. I mean, it probably involved, if it was $1,000, I'd be surprised. And it just sort of subverted the purchasing efforts of the county and, you know, probably damaged computerization of various functions. I mean, in other words, it probably harmed county efforts, and it certainly made other vendors think that there was no track for them to ever be considered. I mean, it was exactly the sort of thing that ethics policy is aimed at. But I don't think that if we took this down to Detroit and talked about Bobby Ferguson and Kwame and Monica Conyers, and you asked them about sporting tickets to hockey games, they would be appalled, and not because of the lack of ethics. Try to get Monica Conyers to throw you a sludge hauling contract by promising her a hockey ticket sometime. I defy you.
Would you say that there is a sufficient awareness of ethics policy on the among the Ingham County Board of Commissioners here in the aftermath of this IT thing? Did it raise the profile of your ethics policy because of this?
Oh, yes. Whenever there's a scandal, it brings people back to thinking about the principles. The Ingham policy is actually quite bizarre, and nobody knows how unusual it is. Nobody has ever wanted to copy it. You know, I wrote that 20 years ago, and people occasionally ask for copies, and they walk away appalled when they see it. It says things, and I'll just give you an example.
Why?
Well, for example, in typical counties, if you go into the county board office, you will discover that whoever's sitting there is a secretary or a board aide is, of course, related to the chair of the board, because that person was hired because it's the board chair's girlfriend or son-in-law or whatever. That's the way it works. In Ingham County, not only do we not hire relatives, we have a policy of discriminating against the relatives of members of the Board of Commissioners. We have a policy of discriminating against the friends of Board of Commissioners members. We have a policy that if a member of the Board of Commissioners calls the HR department and says, I noticed that application, you're taking applications for the nurse practitioner in the health department, the HR person's job involves saying, Commissioner, I do not feel comfortable talking about this with you. I don't think we should discuss this.
You put that together?
Yes, and the board adopted it unanimously, and we do not employ the relatives of county commissioners. Not just that we don't employ them specially, we disqualify them from employment. How about that for weird?
They are overtly disqualified.
They're not absolutely prohibited because there are some situations in which we can't stop it, but we do not hire former county commissioners, okay? They say that Ingham County has a policy of discriminating against former county commissioners for permanent employment. Okay?
But are the members of the Board of Commissioners really aware of the depth of this?
Sometimes,
how comprehensive this is?
Sometimes they forget, and then something like the current little scandal, which I would call like a mini scandal, brings them back to attention and reminds them of the rigors. Ingham County actually has a very proud record of avoiding substantive scandals. And so that when we have a scandal, it involves the IT director accepting hockey tickets from a vendor. I mean, there are plenty of former county commissioners who could be consultants and who could be hired. I mean, for example, myself, right? I have never gotten a nickel, and it's not just because I wouldn't want to. Hell, I'd be happy to take some, right? The ethics policy of Ingham County strongly discourages hiring, even as contractors, the companies of former county commissioners and their relatives and friends.
We've attempted to follow the Ingham Health Plan situation, which appears to have been subject to some mismanagement. The projections over how many people would participate in a post-Obamacare landscape, the wisdom of a millage continuation. Any response to how the dust is settled on this whole situation?
I think the Board of Commissioners ought to admit that the Ingham Health Plan is history and it's not the future. But once you start a program, it's very hard to stop it. Once you have a millage, it's very hard to say, we're not going to levy it anymore. It was the sort of thing when I was on the board that I did. And it got me a reputation for being ruthless and mean and unscrupulous. But everybody on the current Board of Commissioners is much too nice to say, no, we're not going to levy that anymore. We're going to lay off those people. We're going to end the project, the program. So instead of that, they just allow it to kind of drift on. But they ought to admit that the millage was approved in a different environment before we knew the contours of Obamacare. And now that we know those contours and we know what the real needs are out there, they ought to wrap up the millage, stop levying it, and they ought to propose a different millage maybe for a different purpose. But that millage is no longer serving any valid purpose, in my opinion.
What are you reading these days?
A two-volume biography of William Butler Yeats, The Master Poet, is the volume I'm on. I don't think anybody will care about that.
Pollster, Politico, raconteur, bon vivant, Mark Grebner of Practical Political Consulting has been our guest. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, several Lansing neighborhoods on the west side are teaming up to beautify their side of the city. We talked to two of the people behind the Point West Art and Trail Project. Old Oakland Neighborhood Association President Joe Duras and Karen Coyle, treasurer for the West Side Neighborhood Association. First, they opened Zuby's and the Cosmos Pizzeria. Now, Lansing's Potent Potables Project has completed its newest ventures. The Creole Restaurant, which opened about a month ago, as well as the Creole Coffee Company and Cafe, which opened just this week. Yesterday, Current State's Jamie Paisley sat down in Old Town Lansing with Sam Short, the CEO and owner of the Creole, to talk about getting it off the ground.
It's been a rolling process of getting Creole open, starting with the bar and then the restaurant open, and now finally, the third and final bit. Was it always three parts? Because I know the Creole Gallery itself was just the restaurant area here,
sure.
And then there was a bakery next door. Was it always intended to be three different kind of spots?
Not at all. To be perfectly honest, we were just going to open in the Creole location, and we were going to open similar to the way we opened at Zuby's, which was very light apps and a bar. And that was going to be it. And then the space next door became available midway through construction. And so we went, well, it would be really nice to have some extra seats and do some things. We had at the time been talking about opening a breakfast and lunch place and sort of said, this isn't a unique opportunity for us to do that. We can take the whole building. We'll just take over the basement area. We'll take over the space. And the multi-stage rollout came from the fact that we completed this side well before we completed that side and sort of said, well, let's open and at least do something over here. It was, for us, opportunistic rather than any plan, to be perfectly honest. So luckily, we ended up with this great thing that is the Creole on one side, and we do the dinner service, obviously. And then on the other side is the Creole Coffee Company, and that's where we do our lunch and breakfast. So.
And that opened very recently.
Monday.
Exactly.
Monday. So, yeah.
And the process of once you get started, because I know the restaurant's been going on for a while, mm-hmm. and your executive chef, Dan, and I'm going to mess up the last name.
Yeah. Knopnicki.
Knopnicki. Mm-hmm. Kudos on
right.
That process of once you open, as you're at the same time getting something else ready, how was that that stress level, especially during that opening, because you're shifting on a dime to open a new place too.
Sure. Let me just say, thank God we have easy access to alcohol. The stress level in any restaurant opening is high. You have so many moving parts from construction all the way through your operations, food quality. You want to make sure that people are coming in and their first experiences are wonderful. So it's compounded, obviously, when you do it once and then you immediately go and do it again. Dan was great through the whole thing, and we're really lucky in having a veteran team be a part of this. Mimi Yao, who opened Zuby's with us, obviously came over to open this place, and then Dan, obviously, heading up the kitchen. Having done this before with that team really, really helped. Everybody kind of knew strengths and weaknesses and what we needed to do as far as supporting each other, playing off each other's so that we could make sure that we ended up with a product people were going to walk in and go, this is amazing right off the bat, as opposed to a product that they walk in and go, well, I hope they clean up their act in 6 months, which is never what you want to hear. So,
yeah, to get that restaurant building up steam from day one.
Sure.
Exactly.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, we had a lot of push with the fact that Zuby's and Cosmos have been so successful and so known in the area, and so when people heard that we were doing this, we've just gotten a bunch of regulars who have been very interested in coming in and seeing what we're doing, and at least giving us an opportunity to say, hey, we're here, we're serious about food, and we want to make a place in that dining experience that Lansing has that it hasn't seen before.
Now, I've heard of the steam engine, I've heard of like a solar-powered engine, but what in the world is a beer engine? That's a terminology I've never heard of before.
So a beer engine, so it's an interesting concept. So beer is pushed at most bars through draft systems, and you see those hand taps, and you get a draft beer in a pint glass or a stein or a mug or something like that, right? All of that beer is pushed by CO2, forced through the tubes by CO2 out of kegs. Now, traditionally, this wasn't how beer was always made. They didn't have compressed CO2 canisters. You could just hook up to a specialty regulator and do these things. They had a beer engine, which is essentially a hand pump for beer. So instead of getting it in kegs, we get it in a vessel called a firkin, also known as a cask. Things like old school British pub sort of feel. And we set them up downstairs and we hook them up to a very, again, old school pump. It's a siphon system is essentially what it is. And then we have hand pumps upstairs. So rather than forcing carbonation into the fluid, which obviously diffuses in the fluid as well, and then forcing the fluid through the tubes, we literally, by the strength only of our bartender's arms, pull the beer up out of the cask, through the lines, and into your pint. What that does is it gives you a little bit richer, a little creamier head on the beer. You know, when you're drinking a lot of what we call force carbonated beer, you can get a little bit bloated and a little gassy if you have four or five or six and that sort of thing. The same happens at a much slower rate when you're talking about cask ales, because the PSI in a regular beer might be 16 to 18 PSI. In a cask ale, it's 2 or 3 PSI. So you're really, really light. You still get that wonderful creamy head. You still get those things. Think Guinness. You know Guinness, that really creamy sort of nitrogen? Think a head like that as opposed to a really fizzy, bubbly head. And that's what you're talking about with cask ale. So with a cask ale, you're getting a little more pure to style beer, a little more pure to the brewer's vision as far as the beer. So you can get brighter aromas and different things. We just thought it was a really fun thing to do on out here. You don't see a lot of cask engines in the state of Michigan, period. We have three on draft.
And I saw, if I remember correctly, coming in the coffee company, that the full bar is available for lunch service, because right now the restaurant is closed.
Yep.
But you can certainly do that.
Oh, yeah. Bloody Marys and mimosas. If you would like a cocktail or a beer, beer at lunch is one of my favorite parts of this business, to be honest. And it's certainly something that you can have. But we have a full liquor license over there 7 days a week. So come in, get rid of your hangover with some crepes or some of our biscuits and gravy and Bloody Mary. And I think that'll set you right.
I hadn't even thought of that it's a separate location, so you'd need a separate license.
Holy cow.
Could we talk about the Creole restaurant? Because the Creole Gallery was here before this. Did you shape the theme around the Creole Gallery, like that kind of Nolan style?
The building itself actually shaped the Creole Gallery and us, but we certainly took a cue from them. So this building was originally the Creole Cigar Company. It literally, for 50 years, they rolled and wrapped cigars here in this building. And the building actually was three stories at the time. The building's gone through two fires over its history. 150 years it's been around. It's a beautiful, beautiful old building. The first fire took it down to two stories and changed it, and then it became a hardware store. And then was a hardware store for a number of years, was a derelict building for a little while. Then Robert Busby, who was the owner of the Creole Gallery, really, and to be honest, the grandfather of Old Town, just the man that sort of was the heart and soul of this place, took over and opened the Creole Gallery, and owned a number of buildings up and down the strip here that he revitalized and sort of started this kind of bohemian, can-do, art-centric feel that Old Town has. And we have him to thank for a lot of that. But he named it the Creole, I think, a little bit after that Creole Cigar Company moniker. And then, to be perfectly honest, because of the feel of this place. When you look around, you have these walls that Robert did them as walls, but as kind of art installations at the same time. They show through multiple layers of plaster peeling and shaved off the sort of years that this building has seen. And what we wanted to do when we came in here was add to that feeling that I get when I go to New Orleans, which is almost faded glory.
Of the menus that are both at the cafe and the restaurant, what are the ones that are going under the surface? People aren't ordering, but you really want them to try.
Okay, so on the breakfast side of things, I think the one that people don't necessarily try is the salmon tort. I know it's a little odd. Our crepes are fantastic, and everybody's getting the Eggs Benedict about 9 different ways, and you know, and there's some the biscuits and andouille sausage gravy is selling like literally like hotcakes. But that salmon tort is this delicate, this beautiful smoked salmon, and it's just a great sort of breakfast. It's a little unique, and that tort cake is creamy and rich and just decadent. It's just a wonderful play of flavors with a little bit of bitter arugula. On the Creole dinner side of things, so there are two dishes really that to me stand out as far as Dan's just creative nature. One is the charred asparagus. He charred asparagus, shaves truffles, does truffle oil, and then does truffle salt over the asparagus, and then does a runny egg, which is a hard-boiled egg with a soft yolk on the center. It's not the yolk itself is not hard-boiled, just the outside. It's really a complex process to actually make it, and then we actually soak it in Cabernet, so it's got a purple shell on there on the inside, and it's got this beautiful white texture and runny, creamy yolk on the inside, and it's got this great, rich, fatty, umami flavor to it to mix with that sort of truffle and beautifulness on the charred asparagus. The other one is we do essentially a jarret de porc, a pork shank, right? It's similar. If people have had osso buco, a more famous Italian treatment of that, this is the French treatment. But it's a ham hock that we pickle over a couple days, and then we slow roast it, and it's set into sort of dirty rice, red beans and rice, and done whole on the bone and sort of put up on this plate. And it's to die for. It's just, it's evocative of all these things we talked about, this real Creole flavor, and at the same time is like decadently rich and good, and it fills your belly. It's a really wonderful dish.
We talk about the transitions and Zubies over on Grand River, and now this is on Turner Street where we are right now. This kind of more pedestrian friendly here over than it is over Zubies. Was that always part of the eyeing of this locale?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we love Old Town. Aaron Matthews and Al Hooper, my business partners, live and work in Old Town. I'm sorry, Aaron lives outside, but he works in Old Town at Clark. He runs at Clark Hill. Al lives right here in Old Town. So for us, the idea that we could bring new, unique businesses to Old Town wasn't a question of if, it was when, and how do we structure them intelligently, and how do we make sure that we're opening the right things in the right places. So this is certainly our newest venture, but this will not be our last venture in Old Town.
All right, Sam Short, I know you've got people, I think, coming to try and talk to you, so thank you very much for your time. I'll let you get back.
Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate it.
That's Sam Short, CEO and owner of the Creole Complex in Old Town Lansing, part of the Potent Potables Project. You can check out menus from both restaurants online at thecreolelansing.com or just swing by their new, fully completed locale on Turner Street in Old Town. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And coming up on Current State, WKAR's Peter Wharf and MSU College of Music jazz professors Rodney Whittaker and Diego Rivera are behind a new radio documentary celebrating the 50th anniversary of a classic jazz album. We get a preview of the show before it airs this Saturday. That and more after the break on Current State. Yes, our one-day pledge campaign is coming up next Tuesday. We hope you will dial us up then. But then again, of course, we do have the website option, which is kind of to a pledge drive what absentee ballot voting is to the actual election day, right? Just go to WKAR.org and click on the Give Now button. It's Wednesday here on Current State, which means it's time for our weekly Neighbors in Action segment. Neighborhoods in Action might be a better title for today, though. Several communities on the west side of Lansing are joining forces to create a public art and trail project. Here to tell us more, Karen Coyle, a board member for the West Side Neighborhood Association and president of the Old Oakland Neighborhood Association. Also, Joe Duras is president of the Old Oakland Neighborhood Association and Saginaw Oakland Commercial Association. Karen, Joe, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Mark.
And Joe, in your case, welcome back.
Thanks.
You're calling this the Point West Art and Trail Project. It's planned for the area where Saginaw and Oakland converge. Why,
that's right.
Why there?
Well, it's actually the western edge of the city right there. So there's this nice piece of land that MDOT has that is basically just grass right now. And as you either coming into the city, if you come up underneath the railroad bridge where the old Verlinden plant used to be, it just kind of sits there empty. And the way that you know that you're in the city is a very small green sign just on the other side of the railroad bridge that says, "Welcome to Lansing." It kind of sits off to the side of the road. And I think that the reason we picked that place is because it is very visible and it represents the neighborhoods that are right there in the area.
So it's an all-natural area, Karen.
Yes.
Tell us more about what it's going to look like. How big of an area are we talking about?
We're talking about creating a trail that's about a mile around, and it's going to meander through both parks, kind of around the trees and not a straight thing. So you get to see lots of things, including the native perennials that we're going to plant and the wetland that is there.
So people take in the art while they're walking the trail. How will the artists be chosen?
We're going to put out a request for proposals shortly after the first of the year. And we're going to take those in and then figure out how to have the neighborhoods vote on which one they like the best. We're looking for something that kind of embodies the history of the area, plus the future as we look forward.
What do you think this will add to the community, Joe?
A sense of place, Mark. I think that's the most important thing.
We talk about placemaking all the time.
Yeah,
you're trying to accomplish that.
So, I mean, I think that one of the big things for the art is that, you know, if you ask people or people ask you where you're from and you say, "Oh, I live in the west side of Lansing," one of the kind of common responses is, "Oh, over by the Lansing Mall." And I think that the folks that live in the neighborhoods have a lot of pride and they have a lot of, they place a lot of importance on being city dwellers living in the city. And so I think that by having this kind of gateway art project that shows you that you're in Lansing, that represents the neighborhoods, I think it really will provide a sense of place. And then to connect that to the local parks and to connect the West Side neighborhood to the Old Oakland neighborhood with a pair of crosswalks across Oakland and Saginaw will really kind of create that whole West Side feel in Lansing.
Do you have how much budget do you have to work with here? That's always relevant.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we've been doing some fundraising. We've gone after a few different grants. So we currently have a Love Your Block grant from the City of Lansing.
What?
A Love Your Block.
Love
grant.
Your Block.
Yep,
yes.
Love Your
yes.
Block grant. And then we have another grant from the Power of We. So that will help us to kind of get started and do a lot of the design. We're currently running a crowdfunding campaign on Patronicity, which if we get to our goal by the 30th of December, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation will match us one-to-one on that money. So we have the potential to raise another $26,000 from that Patronicity campaign. So I would encourage everybody, if they could, to go to patronicity.com/pointwest and contribute as much as they can. It's tax deductible.
How much would you like to raise at a minimum?
So what we're looking for is to raise about $50,000. With that $50,000, we've talked a lot with the City of Lansing and with the Parks and Recreation Department and with the Park Board. And what we're hoping is with that $50,000, we can then leverage city millage funds that are set aside for improvements in parks so that they can then help assist us with the trail.
We're talking with Joe Duras, president of the Old Oakland Neighborhood Association. Also, Karen Coyle joins us. Karen's the treasurer for the Westside Neighborhood Association. We're talking about proposed plans to build a public art installation and trail on Lansing's west side. Karen, you haven't lived in the West Side neighborhood that long, but you're treasurer now for the Neighborhood Association. You're one of the people leading this project. What was it about the community that inspired you to just jump into something like this, since you haven't been there that long?
Yeah, apparently I don't have a great power for saying no. And
the power of no.
The power of no, yes. I moved into the neighborhood just a year ago, actually, and probably 2 weeks later, one of the current board members approached me and said, you should think about this. So I got involved on the board, and then our treasurer had to leave the board. And I said, oh, heck, I'll give it a try. And this project actually sounded so exciting, and I've worked with Joe on a few other things, and I just thought it was a very important thing for the neighborhood. I'm planning to live in that neighborhood for the next 50 to 75 years.
Okay.
I would really love to have a park.
Joe, tell us more about how the community can participate and weigh in on what they want to see for the space.
Absolutely. So we have a webpage through the Saginaw Oakland Commercial Association that describes the project. We also have a Facebook page for the Saginaw Oakland Commercial Association, which is SOCA. And then in addition, we have a Facebook page just designed for the project. So it gives all the details. It provides the renderings, provides an overview of the project. It also is where we're communicating with folks about meetings, where they can come and give their input. So it's a lot of social media interaction right now. And then we've hosted two public input meetings so far, and we plan to host a few more coming up in the new year.
What role are volunteers playing in this process, Karen? And what role might they play in the future?
We have a great number of plans for volunteers. We're going to do a groundbreaking ceremony in April, and we're looking to create one small space with a bench and some planting so that people can see what it's going to look like. But we're inviting some students from Sexton High School to come. We're just trying to figure out how to get them there because of budgetary issues. And the neighborhood, we're inviting everybody to come and help with cleaning up in the park and maybe doing some raking if we need to, but helping to break the ground and get things moving. We're also going to look for people to help maintain the park. Just keeping an eye on litter and things that are going on there that need to be addressed.
It's unmarked territory now. It's just natural space, or not?
No. So it's currently it's the West Side Park and Dunnaback Park. And in the West Side Park is actually where Lansing Community College plays their baseball games. There's a baseball field there. And it's directly across from that point, that piece of land that we were talking about, just to the north of that.
And the acreage is what?
The acreage on the park is, well, let me see. It's probably about a quarter of a mile on a side. So it's, I don't even know what the acreage of the park is.
Oh, okay.
It's a quarter of a mile down Stanley Street. Yep. So and that's kind of where the mile long loop comes in. So what we're basically trying to do, Mark, is we're trying to utilize some of the space that's not being used right now. It's just empty grass, and we'll meander the trail around through some of those empty spaces in the park and plant wildflower plantings. As Karen mentioned, we're actually going after another small bit of money from a wildflower group that will help support native plantings that will help bees and butterflies and those sorts of things. Mm.
Tell us more about this plan to involve Sexton High School. Mm-hmm. This is the faculty, the student body?
All of the above.
What?
Okay. All of the above. Sexton is actually, I looked it up, and it is a magnet school for science. And I thought, well, that's perfect.
Yeah.
And I'm an educator by training and profession, so I always think about the schools and where they need to be involved in neighborhood things. We've been trying to stay very involved with the schools since the inception of the association, and we've, you know, that's ebbed and flowed over the years, so we were looking for another connection. I contacted the principal of Sexton, who then sent it to her department head, and he and I are conversing about how they can and will continue to be involved.
But you're already at an April groundbreaking, which will be here before you know it. How much of this will take shape in 2016? Percentage-wise?
Right, we anticipate that probably about 60% of it will take place in 2016. Yes. We'll finish likely the following spring, summer, early
summer.
But a
year from now, we should be pretty close to done.
Yeah.
This particular project aside, I'd like to ask both of you about the challenges your neighborhoods might be facing. Karen, what about the West Side neighborhood? If you could change one thing about your neighborhood that is an issue, what would you change?
Well, as with any urban space, you find numbers of young people who don't have things to do other than think about going through cars that aren't locked. Entering doors
that
aren't locked.
Cars that don't belong to them.
That don't belong to them, yes, and checking out what's in there. So that's something that we are hoping to change, and we have a crime and safety committee working on that. There are neighborhood watches, I think, in both neighborhoods that are working on that. And actually having a park where they can go and do other things could help as well.
Joe, what about the Old Oakland neighborhood?
Well, I think from our neighborhood's point of view, there's two kind of big things, but they're really all both centered around connectivity. So I think that people really want access to more local services, and so that's part of what we're trying to do with SOCA is really encourage businesses to be in that space where the neighborhoods will have access to them so that you don't have to get in your car and go drive over into Lansing Township. Instead, you can stay right there and just walk across the street and go to a small grocery, a coffee shop, those sorts of things. Mm. And to that end, too, sidewalks come into play into this a lot. The parks, like I said, is a quarter mile down Stanley Street, and they don't actually have a sidewalk on the parks. And so this trail project will make kind of safe egress for kids who want to play in the parks.
Joe Duras is president of the Old Oakland Neighborhood Association and the Saginaw Oakland Commercial Association. Karen Coyle's a board member for the West Side Neighborhood Association and president of the Old Oakland Neighborhood Association. We've been talking about proposed plans to build a public art installation and trail on Lansing's West Side. Thank you to both of you. Yeah. Happy holidays and best of luck in 2016 with
Happy
this
holidays.
Project.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. We're very excited.
And Current State is always looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured. .5 WKAR in Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. This year, jazz fans worldwide are celebrating a half century of one of the genre's most acclaimed recordings. 1965's A Love Supreme features saxophonist John Coltrane with pianist McCoy Tyner, drummer Elvin Jones, and bassist Jimmy Garrison. Together, the quartet created one of the signature sounds of mid-60s jazz. WKAR celebrates the anniversary in the documentary special, A Love Supreme at 50, that's this Saturday night at 8 o'clock, MSU Director of Jazz Studies Rodney Whitaker and saxophonist Diego Rivera join producer and host Peter Wharf in the one-hour program. Here's a preview of the show, beginning with some of the key voices and sounds of 1965.
The Great Society asked not how much, but how good.
A change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
He's too ugly to be the world champ. The world champ should be pretty like me.
The Spartans of Michigan State, Big Ten champions, national champions, undefeated and untied.
I went into the movement with more negative tendencies than anybody in the movement.
The sounds of 1965, from LBJ to Cassius Clay, the Spartans to the Supremes, the Beatles to Bob Dylan. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary release year of John Coltrane's historic album, A Love Supreme. New Yorker magazine writer Richard Brody called A Love Supreme a holy grail of jazz recordings. A religious philosophy, quasi-symphonic unity, one grand composition in four parts. Here's some of part one called Acknowledgement. Listen for the four-note bass line, acknowledging a love supreme. Saxophonist John Coltrane with pianist McCoy Tyner, drummer Elvin Jones, and bassist Jimmy Garrison with some of the opening track, Acknowledgement, from the 1965 album A Love Supreme. Michigan State University Assistant Professor of Jazz Studies, Saxophone, and Improvisation Diego Rivera recalls his earliest contact with Coltrane.
I first listened to John Coltrane in high school. Or no, even before that, I think I was in middle school. A friend had given me two albums, Giant Steps and Love Supreme, and it terrified me. Just the sheer magnitude and velocity and just the kind of sonic footprint that he had. You talk about velocity. It was pretty arresting. It was an important experience, and I think had it not been for Coltrane, I think my interest in the saxophone and jazz in general would have been severely stunted. In this job, I have students, so I'm able to see their maturation not only musically but personally, and I think that was one of the things that's so honest and endearing about Coltrane's music is that it sounds to me, to my ears anyway, like a person growing up. There's something very, not as musical and not as technical as it is very just, very, very human and very, there's a lot of, you're able to see as humanity progressed.
I believe that our men are to, mm-hmm. are here to grow mm-hmm. themselves into the full, into the best good that they can be. At least this is what I want to do, and, this is my belief. That we are supposed to, I'm supposed to grow to the best good that I can get to. And as I'm going there, becoming this, and when I become, if I ever become, this will just come out of the horn. So whatever that's going to be, that's what it will be. I'm not so much interested in trying to say what it's going to be. I don't know. But I just hope, I realize that good can only bring good.
For Coltrane, I think he was always at his best when he was searching. And if he was searching in the practice room or if he was searching on the bandstand, there's something very, very honest about his music. And so that was always at the forefront. So I think that was Coltrane's best, is when he was always at his best is when he was searching.
MSU saxophonist Diego Rivera also shares one of the most universal observations on the Coltrane style.
One of his contemporaries, who I'm also a big fan of, is Joe Henderson. And I always have this thing that I tell my students when they're studying Joe Henderson and John Coltrane, you know, that Joe Henderson has a million things that he plays, but he plays them each one way. And John Coltrane may have one thing that he plays, but he plays it a million ways, a million different ways.
That was an excerpt of the WKAR documentary special, A Love Supreme at 50. The program celebrates the half-century anniversary of the classic John Coltrane album, A Love Supreme. You can hear that show this Saturday night at 8 o'clock on WKAR 90.5 FM. We hope you will tune in. That's our program for today. We will be taking a little time off the next week or so for the holidays, but we will be live on the air next Tuesday for a show featuring some of our best segments of 2015 during our one-day end-of-year pledge drive. We hope you will tune in, and we hope you will consider making a donation to support the news and music programming you depend on this year here on WKAR. We want to wish all of you and your families a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We will see you again next Tuesday, and we certainly hope and expect to see you in 2016. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. It can go straight to your smartphone every morning. Subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. Enjoy the holidays. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.